Hello and welcome to the LGC News Roundup podcast. My name's Martin George, I'm the LGC Deputy Editor, and today I'm joined by Megan Kenyon, our Senior Reporter. Hi Megan.
Hi Martin.
And by Kirsty Weekly, our Head of Content. Hi Kirsty.
Hi Martin.
So today we'll be looking at why councils are struggling more than ever to provide local leisure facilities. We know there's a housing crisis, but we're having a deep dive into why temporary accommodation is causing councils a particular headache. And with all that gloom about council finances, we're also joined by a special guest who will talk us through how he thinks councils should communicate the kind of bad news they're sometimes having to give residents about their own organisation. And we'll also be bidding a fond farewell to one of our own. But let's just pick up firstly from something we talked about last week. Sadly, all those tweets from council leaders about their local lioness heroes weren't quite enough to propel England to victory on Sunday. Although I'm pretty sure that in the years to come, we'll see plenty of councils naming playing fields and sports facilities after members of the team. But Kirsty, there was a little story came out at the end of last week that sort of highlighted a little bit some of the frustrations you get between central government and local government. And it was about the World Cup.
Yes. So at the very last minute, the Levelling Up Secretary, Michael Gove, wrote to councils suggesting they should do everything they can to enable people to enjoy the football from their pub, and suggesting that, you know, if it was possible to change licensing rules to enable people to buy a beer at 10:30 in the morning, to make that possible. And I think as Mr. Gove will know, because he's in charge of this stuff, it takes at least 5 days to process any requests for licensing changes. And many councils also pointed this out to Mr. Gove. And it led to a bit of a mixed bag in how councils approached it. Some said they wouldn't be enforcing current restrictions as long as a venue had a license to sell alcohol later in the day, they'd be relaxed about it. Others stuck to the letter of the law and said, you know, there are rules here, we can't change them. And some pointed out that they'd set up, you know, big screen venues where people could enjoy the match with a soft drink that they bring along themselves.
And it's one of those things where, you know, it's just that the minister just writes a little letter, sends it to some newspapers, job done from his point of view, yeah. And just lands all this sort of confusion on councils with what one working day to try and sort stuff out. It's a minor example, but it happens all the time, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's not a surprise to us. I'm sure it wasn't a surprise to many councils, but it's nonetheless frustrating if you're the officer charged with sorting this out on a Friday morning.
At least I guess they don't have any victory parades to organise. Am I allowed to say that? Anyway, moving on swiftly. Leisure facilities. So still in the sports arena here, as it were. Yeah. So I know we did a big investigation, our colleague Kwame, earlier in the year about the future of leisure. And it's something's come up in the past week that really shows just how difficult this is for councils at the moment, given all the issues with, you know, utility bills, heating costs, you name it. Kirsty, talk us through it.
Yes. So back in March, when Kwame did that big investigation, what we found was that there were these very recent pressures connected to inflation and energy bills. Leisure centres are quite high users of energy. You know, heating a swimming pool in particular is quite expensive. So there was that, you know, new issue that many were struggling with. But there's a longer systemic problem around underinvestment for many, many years, which means, you know, many council run sports centres that were built back in the 60s and 70s really need upgrading. You know, they're old buildings, things are literally falling apart, and the cost of doing that is quite high.
And of course, there are, you know, the net zero and retrofitting things that, you know, as big users of energy that's a big issue, isn't it?
Yeah. So actually, you know, running these services isn't profitable in the way that it once was. So many councils have outsourced providing their energy, providing leisure services to a variety of companies or charitable organisations, and those organisations too have, you know, staff to pay, bills to pay. So the relationships between those companies and councils are getting more strained. And we saw the update we had this week was from Rutland, where they are struggling to find a new provider to run one of their sports centres. The initial tender process resulted in no sensible bids. And at one point they were looking at whether they were just going to close the sports centre altogether. They've now rerun the tender exercise and fortunately got to the point where they can move to the next stage where they get more detailed bids. But the sort of update from the council was very much, this is a good step that we've got this far, but it's still not a guarantee that there's going to be a provider in place when the existing contract runs out next year.
I think it was really interesting that the reasons why that sort of first attempt last year failed. I think, is it right, the council were trying to get a provider who would take on responsibility for all the utility and heating costs, yes, themselves, and just in the current context, nobody was willing to take that burden, I guess.
No, and I think they've now widened the bids that they'll accept to the council bearing some responsibility for those costs.
Yeah, absolutely. Good news, though, in sport, and it'll solve all our problems. The government is giving £250,000 to 85 councils to install chess tables in public parks. So job done. Problem solved. Moving on, away from leisure and sport this time. Megan, you've been having a really thorough look into the unsustainable costs, I guess, of temporary accommodation. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so I've been spent a few months looking into temporary accommodation. I think it was kind of sparked by London Council's put out some research which said 1 in 50 Londoners is homeless. And when I spoke to London Councils about it, they kind of just voiced the expense which, you know, councils are going to for this. I think primarily because where they would usually have kind of looked to the private sector or to, you know, more traditional forms of temporary accommodation, those options have kind of disappeared, and councils are having to look more and more towards B&B, hotel, hostel accommodation, which is obviously charged per night and it is more expensive. So I have had a big look, you know, bit wider than London at temporary accommodation and how much it's costing councils and the unsustainable, you know, it's just unsustainable, not only on a cost sense, on a financial sense, but it's unsustainable for the people that are having to live in temporary accommodation as well. You know, I spoke to Just Life, which is a homelessness charity, about the fact that people who live in temporary accommodation, in the longer term, they're less likely to be able to find permanent accommodation because of the trauma of being made homeless. And then, you know, the longer you spend in temporary accommodation, the less likely you are to be able to find permanent accommodation. And it's a ripple effect. It will, you know, have a really long term impact on your life. You know, Just Life told me about, some people will arrive at temporary accommodation and there will be no bedding, or a disabled person will have been put in accommodation with a lift that doesn't work. You know, it just doesn't seem like the government has woken up to the gravity of it. And I think councils are just feeling like they're banging their heads against a brick wall because they're, you know, I went to an APPG for London event where someone from Newham Council said, you know, I've been working in the homelessness sector for a really, really long time. This is the worst I've ever, ever seen it. It's just awful. So, yeah.
And Megan, is this the same everywhere, or are there particular parts of the country where the problem is worse than others?
Yeah, so it's not like adult social care where, you know, every upper tier authority is dealing with sort of very, very high costs. There is some sort of geographical variation on this. So obviously London is kind of head and shoulders above the rest of the country in terms of how it's been affected by this problem. But other major hotspots are Luton has got quite high numbers, Birmingham, Manchester, Hastings is a particularly bad one. I know they've been warning that their finances have just been deeply affected by this.
And Megan, I know we're publishing the full results of your investigation next week. So I know people want to look at lgcplus.com to really look at the data you found and some of the human impact, I think, which really does come through. Now, on this podcast, quite a few times now, we've talked about councils and their financial difficulties. So I thought it'd be interesting to talk about how should councils communicate with their residents when they've got really bad or challenging news about their finances? So a bit earlier, I had a chat with Andy Alsop, who's the chair of LG Comms. That's a national body for public sector communications professionals. And he's also head of comms and marketing at Essex County Council. So let's have a quick listen to what Andy had to say. Now, Andy, the reason I wanted to have a chat with you is in the last few weeks, LGC has done quite a few stories about councils and their financial forecasts, and it's often bad news. So I wanted to have a chat just about from the comms side of things. How do councils choose to communicate that potentially bad news to their residents? What are the do's and don'ts? What do they have to really bear in mind when they're doing this?
Well, the first thing to say, Martin, is that this is familiar territory, obviously, having been through the years of austerity and now with the financial pressures that councils are under. There's a lot of experience there in dealing with these sorts of issues. It is absolutely the case that transparency and honesty and openness always apply. In terms of what happens in practice, of course, we're very much driven by a council's decision-making timetable. So when papers come to cabinet or finance committee or whatever the setting is that carry that financial forecasting, and as we get into the autumn, the initial stages of the budget setting process, that really forms the timetable. And where most council communications teams will be is constructing a narrative around what is essentially the spending story of the council as we move toward February and those meetings where the budget is actually set. There are stages that you go through in respect of the forecasting, and there is always messaging that is associated with that. And as you've said, because of stories that we've seen in the past few weeks about the general state of local authority finances, familiar territory to LGC's readers and listeners of the pod, there is quite a negative context to deal with there. But it's a widely understood one, the type of pressures that councils experience in terms of inflation, in terms of utility costs, in terms of cost of living in general, are those that are being experienced by residents and businesses. So I would be very much expecting council communication teams to be contextualising their stories, their budget stories and their decision making in that space. And of course, as you get toward the end of the year, the majority of local authorities will undertake engagement activity and consultations on their budgets. And the engagement there is really important, and demonstrating that that is feeding through into decision making. So no matter how tough the landscape is, how difficult the decisions are, it's always imperative to demonstrate that you've listened to what residents have said, and that, of course, politicians and political leaders have taken that into account in terms of their decision making.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I guess at this stage, we're dealing with forecasts. And as you say, it's not unusual at this stage of the year that forecasts look bad for a council. They've got overspend forecasts, and they'll probably claw a lot of that back by the end of the year, hopefully. Is it important for councils, not to over egg the pudding and worry residents by saying how bad it looks? Are there dangers that some of the politicians involved might want to, you know, spin things so that, you know, it looks bad now but we save the day come, you know, March? I mean, how do you make sure the messaging is transparent and accurate, and, you know, there's not some silly spin that's going to rebound on the council?
Well, let's deal with both ends of that question. The first one, in respect of, is there a sense of over-worrying residents and communities and so on? I think the balance there will always be about being correctly open and transparent, rather than any, I guess, urge to hide the truth away. And let's face it, you know, in today's age of FOI requests and social media and everything else, you're not going to get away with that for long, because the right question will eventually be asked and the answer will have to be given. Councils have been dealing with austerity for, you know, getting on for 15 years now. So the way to deal with that is obviously to talk about the track record and talk about the experience and the sense of trust that communities can have in the council in terms of its ability to deal with that with that situation. In terms of politicians wouldn't be politicians if they didn't want to create the best possible impression, even in very difficult circumstances. They do have to go out and get elected. We understand that. But this is the point when oftentimes communications senior officers and leaders and so on will have to speak truth to authority in terms of calibrating that sense of optimism in terms of the council's ability to deal with a difficult situation, and making sure that what they are articulating in terms of a narrative is authentic, is actually a reflection of the situation. You know, it's difficult to sugarcoat the pill, particularly when, you know, we're dealing with circumstances as difficult as those which are facing local authorities this particular year. So the good advice will always be offered in respect of staying authentic. But of course, you know, the politician concerned, it's their decisions, it's their spending priorities that are going to be communicated. So they have to be central within that process. The real difficulties emerge when you've got officers who are away from politicians in terms of that whole dialogue and decision making process, and then the narrative that is produced from that. So that's the point that communication leaders have to be really aware of and keep an eye on, making sure that everything is really tight in terms of the relationships as you move through the year toward the budget setting process.
Yeah, I guess we were speaking earlier, and the budget setting process, it's a well-oiled machine. Councils do it every year. They know they've got the forecasts coming out now and consultations, you know, in the new year perhaps. If you talk about some councils that have been in intervention recently, often these are about more discrete financial issues, so they're kind of one-offs and there isn't necessarily a well-oiled machine for dealing with them. And sometimes they're very much about mistakes the council itself has made and has got to own up to, I guess. I mean, is it a different strategy for in terms of how you communicate that to residents and local media?
Not in terms of the requirement to be transparent and open about what has happened or what has gone wrong. What can often be difficult if you're thinking about councils within intervention is the complexity and the detail of what's happened. So, for example, if that's in the case of investment decisions which have not yielded the return, and therefore the council has found itself with a financial black hole, for example. I mean, that's crudely put, but listeners will understand what I'm driving at there. The difficulty there can be just how difficult it can be to explain that to wider audiences, residents and businesses and so on. But that is, again, where council communicators have to work closely with their finance colleagues and politicians, obviously, to make sure that the narrative is right, it's understandable and it's credible. That can be very difficult indeed. And of course, some of those situations do find themselves in a space where you can't tell the whole story because there may be legal proceedings and so on. So there is a level of and a layer of complexity there that can be even more challenging. What's important is that in terms of the how that particular piece fits into the overall narrative, that you don't lose that overarching thread and story about what's been happening at the council and its strategy to recover and get itself out of trouble.
Yes, there must be some really difficult conversations though, if it's the council has been at fault or found wanting, and then it has to then acknowledge that or admit its own wrongdoing or culpability. That must make it a harder process to go through and get everybody on board and to do genuinely. Presumably that delays things and people may be less forthcoming at certain points. It must be a lot more complicated for those reasons than the annual budget bad news.
Yes, it is. The as you said, the budget process is a perennial, happens every year, usually characterised by well-oiled machinery and processes and so on and so forth. When a council goes into intervention, it's a completely different dynamic and a much broader dynamic, and one that has wider impacts and implications, particularly in the political sphere. It is a long-term process in terms of the council's recovery and the narrative that runs along with it, and it has to change as well, because the authority will move through the various stages and elements of its recovery, but over as we are seeing now, a number of years. So that is very much a medium to long term piece, and therefore a kind of different approach is often required in terms of communications. But having that overarching story element is really important. And what is always so important in respect of intervention is re-establishing the trust in the local authority that will have been damaged or even in some cases broken by the circumstances they've found themselves in. And that takes time. It takes time.
Thanks, Martin. That was really interesting.
So, I mean, I guess Andy's outlined there the theory of what councils should do. As journalists, we've all had a lot of contact with councils about their finances. Do we find that they're really good at being transparent and wanting to talk about these difficult financial situations when they find in them? I mean, Kirsty, what's your experience been?
I think it's probably hit and miss. I think every council has its own approach to transparency and what that looks like and feels like. And some councils will invite us to media briefings to hear the leader and the finance member outline exactly what's going on. And very often that's a sensible tactic to get on the front foot and invite the media in rather than let us stumble across meeting papers, which as LGC journalists we're always stumbling across finance papers in council meetings. One of the cynical views is that those councils that have got new administrations find it easier to be upfront about how difficult the financial situation is. If you weren't involved in setting the original budget and being in control of the finances, it's you don't bear the responsibility for things having not gone to plan in the same way that you do.
Absolutely, yeah. A lot of political messaging and political calculation, yes. Laid into these decisions.
Yeah, that's not to say that that's the case for every council, but as a...
Yeah, of course. Now, Megan, this is the sad bit of the podcast. you've been with us for 2 years, but now you're moving on to something called The New Statesman, is it? Is that what it's called?
Small publication.
I heard about it somewhere, but yeah, I mean, congratulations. It's a great move, and you'll be fantastic there. So you joined LGC a couple of years ago, and you hadn't had any real deep involvement with the local government sector up to then? Am I right in saying?
I had written one piece when I was a student about local councils and climate change. But to be honest, I look back on that and I think, wow, there's a lot I really didn't know. I think I was always very interested in local government. And I remember when I got the job, one of my friends was like, of course, you've gone for, local government and politics, like that's very you. So it felt, it's my first big job after graduating from my journalism degree. So yeah, but no, I didn't really have a background in it.
so if someone has come in from a standing start and then you've really plunged in depth into some lots of really sticky, messy policy issues with local government, do you have any reflections from what you've learned about local government?
Yeah, I think for me the biggest thing was finding out more about social care. I mean, that's a policy area that I suppose just from what stage I'm at in my life hadn't really had much of an interaction with it. And to be honest, I didn't actually even realise that social care was the responsibility of councils. But I think for me, that has been one of the most interesting policy areas I've really got to get to grips with. I think if it's so vital that we fix social care. I mean, I think Liz Kendall, who's the shadow care minister, was saying earlier this year, care is of such value to the economy and productivity, because I did a piece with the Health Foundation earlier this year. Unpaid carers make up such a big proportion of social care, and actually that is a lot of work goes into that. And I just think that it's often seen, social care is often seen as like the reason why the NHS is crumbling, or the reason why people can't be moved out of their hospital beds and things like that. But it's so much more than that. And I found it a real privilege to be able to kind of get to grips with that and really get under the skin of that policy area, because I feel like it's one that is so vital and just isn't going away. I think one other final reflection I would give is that I don't mean this in a mean way to local government, but I do think that it needs to look at how it can bring on more younger people, because I've definitely noticed that as sort of someone in my first job out of university, looking at local government and kind of who I've spoken to, I think there is a real gap there for bringing in a younger generation. And that is my sort of departing message to the sector, is you need to work out how to better bring on board people who are fresh out of university, because it's such a vital, vital sector to work in. And I think it would be a real shame if, graduates weren't being made as aware as they could be of that. So, yes.
I think that's a really, really good point to conclude on. But Kirsty.
Yeah. Thank you, Megan. We're all gonna miss you a lot. And our knowledge of Taylor Swift will plummet.
Yes. Well, I mean, you can always ask me for tips if you need them.
We all follow you on Twitter. Don't worry, we'll see all the Taylor Swift updates from there. But no, it genuinely, as Kirsty said, it's been a pleasure working with you, Megan, and look forward to seeing your career continue to soar in the years to come.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. It's been a pleasure, as always. Do check our news stories on lgcplus.com. Do like this podcast, subscribe to it, share it with your friends, and also look out for our other podcast, The Local Authority, where we have a deep dive into a single issue that really affects the sector. But for now, thanks for listening.